There's certain specialized technologies, and we could probably end up illiterate, you know, honestly, if our whole life ways changed. So like that information would be lost. And then there's the intentional.
I think we're rapidly getting there already.
Yeah, so no, yeah, we might end on that today.
Well, and thanks for tuning in.
Happy Friday.
Yeah, a bright day on the Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. Yeah.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in Manchester, New Hampshire, and I'm joined, as I am just about every fortnight, by Ken Holyoke in Lethbridge, Alberta. How are you, Ken?
I am very well, Gabe. And so the listener can't see. Actually, well, the listener might see this one because we might have video content on this one. But I am in my office, not the home studio, not Studio 582. I can't remember what I call it. Gabe is actually sporting.
Has there
some
been something stressful in your life?
Yeah. The last couple of weeks have been a little bit interesting for Ken and my wife and my family. Lots of gratitude go to Brian and Elaine, my in-laws, for helping us out this week. And they might not know this, but they will be sticking around until such time as the public school system is welcoming my children back through the door. So.
It might be the Florida public school system, but it'll be the public school system.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see how things shake out. Right now, all that's shaking are the rage clenched fists of every parent in Alberta. So,
and the listener can't see this, or maybe they can, but the Ken's wearing a literal Aloha shirt. It says Aloha on it.
It does. Yeah, and I think it says fishing somewhere else too. Aloha. Explore, yeah, lots of fun stuff.
So
it's 20 degrees here.
It's a warm October.
It's 20 degrees here today, so I figured I'd bring back a little bit of summer.
Well, that's great. And Ken, we've got an exciting episode lined up for the listener. We'd been remiss for a long time. We hadn't had Don Holly on, who's old friend, he's a friend of ours, friend of the show, but also goes back a ways in New Brunswick archaeology, because I believe he took his field school in New Brunswick.
Yeah, he was on one of Dave Black's. He was on the Weir project, wasn't he?
I'm not sure which one, but one of those coastal projects.
Yeah, and so kind of an interesting connection. So the first archaeologist I worked for in CRM, Darcy Dignam, who we also haven't had on the show.
That's right. Yeah.
Darcy, in the first year I was working in archaeology, took off at one point during the summer to go do a dig in like Labrador or something.
Really?
And I was like, geez, that's kind of odd. And I was like, what motivated that? And I think actually, and I guess I forgot to ask Don about this. I'm assuming he was going to meet up with Don because they've known each other since like the early 90s, basically, out of that work at
Dave's. I assume so. I don't know.
Yeah. In any case,
it's a small world, listener.
A very small world. And so other than talking to Robin Wojwitka and Michael O'Rourke last year, we've had no subarctic content.
Mm-hmm. But Ken, it's interesting because we're the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, and so another way to look at it is that it's strange we have any subarctic content.
Well, this is true, right? And increasingly, that subarctic is going to get further away from us. Much the same as the anthropologists of yore went to the north to try to find that pristine, primitive nature. They will be continuing to have to keep going north because that untouched northerly region is going further and further away from us every day.
It's true. And listener, if you thought Nova Scotia wine was bad, just wait until you've tried that fine light or red.
Vinland will finally be in Newfoundland.
Exactly. But one thing about that though, Ken, is that it's interesting, isn't it, that despite this this range that we're covering on the podcast, that we are still called the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. And because of our pact with our listener, we would really like a new name for this podcast, and we would like it to be from the listener, because we have obviously some of the sharpest listeners around. But the listener might be reluctant to just send in that name if they thought we were going to steal it and not reward them.
That's right. Yeah.
But would we ever do that?
We always believe in proper remuneration. You know, we're both unionized employees, Gabe, and and labor rights are at the fore where I am today. And certainly we believe that all intellectual property should be the owner of the person who produces it, and they should be, if not, they should be adequately either licensed or remunerated. So
exactly. And how, Ken, if someone were to rename this podcast today, where would they send that new name?
They would send that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. They can also reach us on Instagram @new_Brunswick_archaeology, and archaeology spelled the same way.
Mm-hmm. And what would they get if we decided to use their name?
Well, so Gabe, we're going to go back in time when we talked to Don here, but on the day that we recorded with Don, it was a rather auspicious day. It was the release of Taylor Swift's new album. And so
I remember that.
Yeah. So this fortnight, listeners are being treated to a conversation with Don Holly. And in the afterglow of that interview, and as our listeners know all too well, we leaned into the popularity of one up-and-coming billionaire female singer-songwriter extraordinaire, Taylor Swift. Now, at the NBARC pod, we're not above trying to cash in on that sweet, sweet SEO, and we suspect it hits different when Miss Swift and her vast catalog is at play. So hold on, listener. As Gabe wishes you would, and I wish you would, we're looking for a new name for this podcast. And I'm going to get you back. Sorry, we will get you back by rewarding you with this timeless prize package. Now, Gabe... Gabe sometimes goes by Mr. Perfectly Fine, but he is not fine with our current podcast name. So we at the NBARC pod have found a way to fill your fall with wonderful things. That's right, the cruel summer is over, and even September has passed, but we're into fall. And while depending on your point of view, we're either speedrunning into hell, or we're witnessing the last great American dynasty south of the border. Maybe both. Or maybe we're just south of knowing. Or maybe we're just south of knowing why we realize that an exploration of the muse for Taylor Swift's work requires a trip off to the United States. And so as the Ice Age...
I can't tell if these are Taylor Swift quotes or not. I assume they are.
So I have read at least 20 song titles from Taylor Swift.
Okay, so that's far why, in this that's project. Why I hear, that's why I hear the listeners piling up. This is great news.
I'll continue here. So as the ICE agents reaches to pull you out of the vehicle, shake it off, listener, and welcome to New York. That's right. Our first destination is the Big Apple. And while you might need a few minutes to gather your bearings, long story short, we mean what we say. You're about to spend a few days in the concrete labyrinth of the five boroughs. And like the lyrics of her famous song, you'll be exploring newfound freedom and perhaps a lighthearted attitude to your past breakups. Filled with wide-eyed optimism, you too will head up to Tribeca and realize that when Sinatra sang, "If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere," he was actually referring to the rental prices. But worry not, listener, the NBARC pod has you covered. We have found you a roost for your time in NYC, where you can eat dinner and sleep in the same space for a cool $3,300 a month. That's US dollars. I know places, and you'll know places that Taylor frequents in New York City after this trip. We're not going to start off fancy. No, we're going to head down to Brooklyn to grab at a pie at Luchali's before wandering around New Amsterdam and learning about the fascinating historical archaeology in the area. It wouldn't be a trip to New York without a visit to Coney Island. So after spending the rest of your day there, we're headed back over to Manhattan Island, to Greenwich Village, and see what I did there, Gabe. There's some continuities. We were talking about Greenwich Village in the last episode.
Yeah.
It's at least 7 stops on the subway for an evening at the Comedy Shop, and then you're wandering about for your evening. But you're wondering, how did it end? Well,
sounds
you went around...
enchant.
You went around the corner to Minetta Tavern for a dinner not unlike the one that Taylor had with her pal Phoebe Bridgers. You'll indulge in baked oysters, scallops, Dover sole, and lobster vol-au-vent. But don't blame me if I go for the famous burger, just like Taylor did on, or Taylor said she would on her next visit. Now, I said this was a fall-themed package, and so to enjoy the colors of southern New England and get away from it all, you're going to hop in your getaway car, which in this case is the same Maserati Taylor references in red, and you're going to make it to Florida. And just like the 2024 Southern Gothic melodrama duet featuring Florence Welch, we are going to get away from all the weed and little babies because the highway don't care, and we want a little warmth. Yes. You're headed to Destin, Florida, via Carolina and other Atlantic seaboard states to the Panhandle. And there you'll take in the beauty of the beach and the world's luckiest fishing village to head out on the high seas for fishing, snorkeling, and maybe even see where those pre-contact or pre-Clovis people cross the Gulf of Mexico. Or if you're hoping to avoid having to come home fresh out of the slammer, whatever it's called now. Hey, Stephen. Oh, sorry. Hey, Gabe. Now, you're probably wondering how we wrap up such a trip where we've really touched on holy ground in the Tay-Tay pantheon. I can see you're wondering where we're headed, and I'll admit I'll feel guilty as sin if I didn't include this last gorgeous destination. That's right, we're headed up to Pennsylvania, to Pine Ridge Christmas Tree Farm, where it all began. So grab your cardigan, and it long live the OG Taylor Swift tracks. Yes, if this was a movie, we might be standing under a willow. But in this case, we're going to harvest. Wait, well, it might have to be hot willows. Uh-oh. According to a 2021 Facebook post, the Pine Ridge Christmas Tree Farm is now closed. So perhaps that's karma biting me for making light of the pantheon of Taylor's music. But I guess the listener is stuck at asking, is it over now? You might even be all colors of maroon with rage that we did not get the chance to chop down a tree on the legendary farm. But I'll tell you what, Gabe, this prize read has made me realize I've taken on a bit of a mirror ball personality here, trying to please everyone with everything. I guess that's just the result of being one of those new romantics. I guess what I was hoping for with this prize... I guess what I was hoping for with this prize is that our listener found a place in this world that they were happy in. So if they're ready for it, we would love to hear a new name for the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.
We certainly would. And Ken, if... I'm sort of at a loss here, Ken, because I think you know a lot more about Taylor Swift than I do, and so I don't really have much to say. But if they were to want to send that in, where would they send it to?
They would send that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY. newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com, and you can also send us a direct message on Instagram at @new_Brunswick_archaeology, and archaeology spelled the same way.
That's right. And Ken, if we go into that mailbag, what is there?
What is there indeed? Let's pull that up.
So also, Ken, am I right that T-Swift has a song called Fortnite?
I don't know. I forgot to bold. I didn't take a total tally of how many I fit in there, but I got through most of the Wikipedia entry. I will tell you that much.
Interesting.
Oh, right. Look at this. We have some listener mail.
Oh, we have some listener mail. Okay.
Okay. So we've got a message from the LinkedIn team. I don't know. Mm-hmm, that's probably because... Oh, yes. We have a LinkedIn page now. That's...
that's right.
So
how does the listener find that?
How do they find that? Just a second, folks.
All right.
Gabe, you're gonna do that stalling thing.
This is live radio.
Yeah.
This is how this works. I'm usually the way this happens... It's just so rare to be on the talking to Ken and have this experience, listener. So I'm actually going to just pause and let you soak it in. See, it didn't last long, folks. But
Okay,
LinkedIn being the like Facebook for MBAs.
Yes. So the problem, because we're super admins, Gabe, it actually doesn't give me the name of the page.
Oh, interesting. But if they just Google LinkedIn New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, they'd probably find it, right?
Oh, yeah. So it's linkedin.com/company/new-brunswick-archaeology-podcast. So I think just go to LinkedIn.
All one word.
All one word. I think that, listener, just head over to LinkedIn and follow us,
right.
And you can send us a message there as well. Oh, we have a message on Reddit, actually.
On Reddit?
Oh, no, it's just telling us, I think it's actually our account is getting deleted because we haven't used it for so long.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Okay. Podmachine.strat is letting us know it's the last chance for a free podcast episode edit. Well, joke's on you, Podmachine. We already have Emmanuel and Cody on the task. And so getting to the real mail, Dimity. The title says some stuff. Hi, guys. First of all, as usual, I love the podcast, regardless of what it's called. You're doing a great job of linking your listeners to all kinds of information from many sources. Congratulations. Well, thank you, Dimity. Well,
thanks so much, Dimity. Really appreciate it. And good to hear from you, Dimity.
And we actually have a, Dimity, we have a hit piece coming up that features some of the research that you talked about when you were on the show. So stay tuned. It won't be on this episode, but it'll be on a future episode. So I was listening to the podcast a couple of months ago when you had Chris Doerr on. It was a great podcast, and his views, especially on the future for upcoming wannabes, was dire, but then nothing has changed. Unless you're an academic or own a CRM company, you do have to look for other work to survive, although in my case, it has led to many other opportunities interspersed with Archie work or Arco work. However, the best thing that was that Chris is right up the road from Tubac in Tucson, so I contacted him about doing a talk for our lecture series, he said yes. He didn't want to prepare anything formal, so he and I are going to have a chat over wine and cheese and talk archaeology. Sort of like a podcast, eh? That's awesome.
I'm glad we're having good connections here.
That is great. Yeah, so the audience can ask questions and tell us why they always wanted to be an archaeologist, and we will tell them why they really didn't. It'll be fun, and I thank you so much. I'll try to remember to tape it, and I'll send it to you guys. Oh, that's fantastic, Dimity. That's
terrific.
Really great to
thank
hear.
Thank you very much, Dimity.
On a personal note,
I'm glad that we're helping with networking in Arizona.
And we're moving back to BC permanently in the next few months. I miss the ocean and the trees, and it's not a bad time to convert the US money into Canadian dollars. A little less sun, but a lot less Trump.
Fair enough.
Keep up the good work. I hope you both have a fun year. I'll try to keep thinking up a new name so I can win the prize. Dimity, that's fantastic. It's great to hear from
you. Thank you very much,
Dimity. Next time we're on the West Coast, maybe we'll have to... Actually, if you're going to be in BC before the spring, we are probably going to be doing a podcast associated with the Canadian Archaeological Association annual meeting in Canmore. And so we're working out some details, listener, but you heard it here first, that there will likely be a live NBArcPod podcast in Canmore in May of 2026. So
that's right. We're trying to figure out, basically a venue at this
point.
Like, it'll be near the meeting, obviously, or maybe even at the meeting, but if you're at the CAA, odds are there will be a podcast.
Exactly. So,
yeah.
And the other one is from Tammy, and it's titled Cats.
Uh-oh.
Hi, Ken and Gabe. Longtime
the
listener.
Broadway musical?
Longtime listener, second time caller.
We told the listener what you were wearing. We didn't say how I'm dressed.
Gabe's tail is swishing.
Memories.
Hopefully it's not like the movie version there with you. Hi, Ken and Gabe, longtime listener, second time caller. Hello again from Ohio. Yeah. So I'm glad you actually wrote again, Tammy, because I thought Gabe's crude remarks about Ohio were unfair and uncalled for. And I'm glad you stuck with us.
But I think we actually figured out, though, Ken, that Tammy, she's like, I think she's near Marietta, which is actually a fairly beautiful part of Ohio.
Yeah. I mean, parts of Ohio are, I think would be beautiful. I've never been. I'm just going to...
Marietta's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Tammy's in the only nice part of Ohio.
I've been enjoying the podcast still, and it continues to bring me personally back in time as we all travel back in time collectively. That said, I thought someone should tell you the truth that if you both admit to being cat enthusiasts and having cats, but fail to describe the cats or post pictures to your social media, you run the risk of alienating your beloved fans who might like cats as well as rocks. Tammy. So Tammy, cat, Pickles is not on Instagram yet, but Pickles is a very cute gray tabby. And maybe I will post a picture of her on social media here sometime soon. But Elwood,
we could do a cat post probably on the Instagram.
We could feature cats of NBArcPod, but we would also have to link in. Elwood has his own Instagram page.
He does. I'm actually looking this up right now. Elwood is he's mostly a Maine Coon cat. He's a small Maine Coon cat. He's a tuxedo, and he is a fantastic cat. I did not really realize how much I needed a cat until I had a cat. We ended up getting this cat through a series of circumstances that included me saying to my partner, I don't think we need a cat. And then knowing we were getting this cat. And then I tried to play it very cool and act like I didn't think we needed this cat. And then the pandemic rolled around and I was still pretending that I was not attached to this cat. And the picture of me on the first day working at home with the pandemic is of Elwood, my cat, spread across me, having a nap, very happy with work from home. And he can be found at, I'm just looking this up here, Mr.Elwood.Shackleton.
There you go. And you will
find his socials there.
I've always had cats. My wife absolutely loves dogs, but we realized that this is not the time of our lives to have dogs. Dogs are a little bit more of a commitment. I love cats. I'm not a huge dog fan. Carolyn is not a huge cat fan, but I think that Carolyn is a very big Pickles fan. So Pickles has found her place, not sleeping on the end of our bed, but wedging herself between the two of our pillows on our bed at night. And that's and I think that's a sign that Pickles has endeared herself in a way to Carolyn that I think that Carolyn was not anticipating. So yeah,
that's great.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for writing in, Tammy.
Yeah, thank you, Tammy. So that is,
and we'll try to keep some cat updates in the show.
Yes, yeah. Now that we know that the listeners are asking for it, we can certainly make sure that we are making cat content. You hear that, Cody and Emmanuel? We need some cat content. So
cat content. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Memories.
Is that actually from Cats?
I think so, isn't it?
Yeah, I've never actually seen Cats, so it's one I've missed actually.
That's right. Well,
you can imagine.
Well, get the kids. You can learn all about Mr. Mistopheles.
I'll take your word for it.
Ken, if the listener wants to write in, where can they send their emails?
They're going to send that to newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word, archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY. newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. On Instagram, @new_Brunswick_archaeology. And now on LinkedIn, new-Brunswick-archaeology-podcast. I think if you Google us, we're the only New Brunswick Archaeology podcast. So
for now, yes.
For now, yeah.
Except
no alternatives. Only the other ones.
Yeah, should we head to Newfoundland?
I think let's take a trip up the coast to Atlantic Canada, or to the farthest northeast of Atlantic Canada.
All right, we'll talk to you in a minute, listener.
Talk to you soon, listener.
Today we're joined by Dr. Donald Holley of Eastern Illinois University. Don received his BA at Penn State and his MA and PhD at Brown. Since 1995, his archaeological work has focused on Newfoundland, and especially the Bayothic, and more recently the first colonization of the island with Chris Wolfe. Don also maintains a broad interest in hunter-gatherers, and we highly recommend his influential co-edited volume, Hunter-Gatherer Archaeology as Historical Process. He's the author of numerous articles about these topics in such journals as Archaeological Method and Theory, the Cambridge Archaeological Journal, Arctic Anthropology, and American Anthropologist. He's also the author of History in the Making, the Archaeology of the Eastern Subarctic. Welcome to the show, Don.
Hello.
Yes, welcome, Don.
Hello, guys. Hello, audience. Thanks for having me on today.
Yeah, well, we're happy to have
Thanks
you
for
finally.
Joining us.
We were saying that when we sent out the invitation, we felt like we'd been remiss for quite a while, so...
You also had a way of vanishing at conferences when the microphone appeared.
Yeah.
You would sort of scamper away.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've written about a lot, Don, but we thought today we're going to talk a little bit, start with the Bayothic. And so we thought that for the listener, could you maybe start with telling us a little bit about the Bayothic, some of the basics, where and when type information, so geography, temporal scope, and sort of broadly what we're talking about when we talk about Bayothic.
Sure. Bayothic are an indigenous people who occupied the island of Newfoundland from basically the dawn of the Common Era to the middle of the 19th century or so. They arrived via Labrador, Quebec, Lower North Shore for the first several centuries or so, shared the island with the Dorset Paleo-Inuit people. I think we're going to talk about maybe later. I use the word share here, but, you know, the Dorset had their places on the landscape. Ancestral Bayothic had their places on the landscape. Dorset were on the island for close to a millennium, and then retreated north when there was some environmental change and kind of reduced harp seal populations and seemed to have upended sort of their economy. And the Beothuk kind of spread out from there and adopted a sort of generalized coastal interior lifeway, living at the bottoms of deep bays and inlets, you know, heading out to the outer coast for seals, heading into the interior for caribou. And that was sort of the situation when European fishermen arrived in the 1500s or so. I don't know, you know, how much detail you want me to go into or to continue or.
Oh, that's great. I mean, and so, but one of the things that I guess would be helpful, maybe just for the listener, there's kind of the terminological thing now with like Beothuk and ancestral Beothuk. Could you unpack that so the literature makes sense for people?
Yes.
I thought you were just about to take a deep breath and say, no.
So, I guess you could say the sort of archaeology of the Beothuk begins on the island with what used to be called the recent Indian period. And, you know, people are still bouncing around terms on what to use. They're all kind of problematic, or most of them are to one extent or another, right? If you start talking about late pre-contact, then it makes sort of the European counter experience the thing. Prehistory is problematic. I know, Gabe, you've been, you know, using kind of a, I think, late boreal, I guess it would be in that time period. So, there's a variety. I mean, if you really want to go in the weeds, there's a variety of complexes sort of in that early time period, cowhead complex, beaches complex, that's sort of on the early end, and then followed by what we call the Little Passage complex, which would be from about 5,000 Common Era to 1500. And then after that, we just start calling them the Beothuk because, you know, that's kind of the historic period.
Great. That sounds good. And one of the things that you've written a lot about actually are those interactions among the Beothuk and Europeans, and in particular about indirect exchange.
Yep.
Could you just tell us a little bit about the interactions among Beothuk and Europeans?
Yep. So I would say in the, you know, for the first century or two, pretty much the Beothuk continued to kind of live as they had in that sort of late pre-contact period. They were living at the bottoms of deep bays and inlets. Europeans are mostly kind of on the outer coast area, so they're not going really into these deep bays and inlets. Of course, geography's varied, so there are places where it seems like fishermen maybe got the Beothuk sort of out of those areas pretty quickly. But they both sort of, I think the Beothuk are kind of living as they had. And then when the fishermen would go back to Europe, because this was a seasonal fishery, the Beothuk would sort of move in and scavenge stuff that was left behind, nails and nets and whatever they could find.
You sort of see an increasing number of European goods, basically, on these Beothuk sites at around that time. Eh?
Yeah. There's probably some actual trading encounters. You know, of course, a lot of stuff is just not known to the archives, and you could just imagine all these, like, thousand little encounter experiences, good and bad, and I'll circle back to that. But, you know, so probably some direct trade. I mean, the most famous is what happened with John Guy in the early 1600s, where kind of waved some Beothuk, you know, to shore, and they had an afternoon of sort of eating food together and trading. So you know, you can imagine things like that happening. And then there's what's commonly known in anthropology as silent trade, and I think that was very important. And silent trade is when you're trading with people without direct interaction. So the kind of the way this worked for the Beothuk is, you leave some sort of furs and stuff hanging from a tree or in some promontory area where a passing ship would see it. And then the ship would pull ashore and grab those furs and then leave things that they would think the Beothuk would want in exchange. And then it would continue, right? The Beothuk would probably show up there, whatever, within some period of time and take those nails and nets or whatever was left behind and leave some furs. I think silent trade works for mobile people, obviously, right? You don't have to like be there. But the one thing we know from anthropology is you find silent trade where there's a lot of distrust and where there's danger and where there's power differences. And as you could imagine, you're a small group of hunters and gatherers, and here comes a ship. Do you really want to like meet them on the shore? You don't speak the language. A lot of bad things could happen, you know, stuff lost in translation. I don't know. You don't know. So really what the other people's, but like, you know, what they have in mind. And so it's better to just not directly trade with these people, but you know, you want their goods. So silent trade's an option.
So in those sorts of interactions, can you see in the archaeological record or can you see in some writing, like how are they interpreting what the other wants left? Are they building on some earlier encounter, or is there just an assumption that like they're going to like this particular kind of axe and the Beothic are assuming that they're going to want these furs? What are they basing on sort of these sort of passive exchange relationships?
I mean, that's a good question. I don't have an answer for. I don't think we have that resolution of where people are thinking it through. I think they're probably just coming to some reasonable conclusions. But you're right. It's a good question. How do you know what people want? But maybe it's not that hard to figure out. I mean, I'll give you like, let's talk about like a non-Beothic example. I believe it's like from Southeast Asia where you have, again, hunter-gatherer groups that would leave stuff on a trail heading into like an agricultural village. And, you know, the farmers would come out and grab that, you know, they want those bush foods or products or medicines or whatever. And then they would leave, you know, rice, a pot of rice or some other things on that trail. And they would trade that way. I give the example in my class about, and you can cut this later if you don't, you know, want this in there, but I grew up in
leave
like
it in, Emmanuel, whatever he says,
yeah,
leave it in.
Yeah, exactly. Leave it in, it's fine. I grew up in the 70s in just outside New York City, and I witnessed some drug deals once. And basically it was people dropping bags into a trash can, and then some time would pass and somebody would come pick it up and leave something else. But if you think about it, it's silent trade. And, you know, do you really want to meet this person in an alley and have that exchange where you don't know if they're just going to take your money or take your drugs? But they obviously want the trade to happen. So it's a safe way of doing it. So, all right, circling back, I think like what this tells me is this was an unpredictable time. You know, the first century and a half, and I know you're both familiar with this area of the world too. It's like the wild, I think of it as the Wild West or the Wild East. There's opportunities to get to make money and to get killed. And we see, I think, with your areas of expertise, but Wabanaki Confederacy, you know, you have Mi'kmaq adopting shallops, and, you know, there's expansion, there's opportunities to be middlemen, to make money. You have the Inuit moving down. But if you think about these ships from Europe, it's like each ship is its own actor, right? You don't even like, even if they're flying the same flag, you don't know how they're going to interact, right? And they're coming to the quote new world with, you know, who knows what kind of ideas of the indigenous people. And I imagine some are shooting and kidnapping, and others are willing to trade, but you have no idea who you're getting. And I think silent trade is sort of the logical strategy there.
And there's some reason to be distrustful too, right? I mean, the Europeans, there's kidnapping and there's some real bad stuff that happens despite this policy of avoidance, right?
Yeah. And they're seasonal, right? I mean, so that's the other thing. So if you have a settled colony or something, you might learn to trust them or know that they can't be trusted, but you know who you're dealing with. And I think here it's just, you don't even know who you're going to about to interact with.
And, yeah. And so in the pre-contact, you're talking about Beothuk are kind of moving between the interior and the coast. And do you see after Europeans are arriving in the seasonal pattern, do you see shifts in the settlement pattern? So are you starting to see sort of, you know, there's, it used, you know, it's, mm-hmm. is it always coast in the summer and interior in the winter? Or is it just, you know, the coast becomes more favored in the summer in the post European contact period, or it's not, it's kind of hard to tell.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is what you're getting at, but I'm of the opinion that things start to change pretty significantly, you know, in the, certainly in the 1700s. And you have the increased number of fishermen that are coming for the seasonal fishery, but you also have people now starting to settle on the island. And when people settle on the island, they start living like indigenous people in a lot of ways. In the sense, like, you know, it's a different food economy, right? When you're just going there and you're fishing in the spring and summer, if you're going to sort of make a year out of it, you're going to need to kind of broaden your, what you're doing. And so you have people starting to get involved in the salmon fishery. That seems to have been really important in kind of affecting the Beothuk, but sealing as well. They're also probably moving now into those spots where the Beothuk were sheltered, right? Those intercoastal areas that they didn't really care about when you had just a narrow fishing economy. But when it broadens, people are sort of expanding, and maybe population too. So this is when I think things turn, especially with the salmon fishery. You have Europeans sort of setting nets up across the whole river and just stopping the ascent of salmon. And so you got the Beothuk kind of coming downstream and starting to tear down nets. And this is when sort of violence picks up. As I think both of you know from my writing, I think there's like, you look at like the structure of sort of relations previously and they start setting the stage. So you had that silent trade period we were just talking about that did nothing for kind of establishing a foundation of relationships, and now things are going sort of sour. So there's violence, and the Beothuk are, you know, clearly outnumbered. They're probably outnumbered since the 1500s, honestly. And then, they retreat increasingly inland, and I think become these pretty specialized caribou hunters. Now, that doesn't mean they're not abandoning the coast completely. But if you're familiar with sort of Newfoundland archaeology or the Beothuk, there used to be these kind of large settlements. Boyd's Cove's a famous one. Beaches is a famous one, where there's, you know, these houses sort of and villages almost on the coast. And I think those days start becoming numbered. Certainly they're getting out to the coast, but you're probably not setting up a big camp there, certainly on some promontory, you know, some prominent spot on the landscape. So Beothuk move inland and really start focusing on caribou. And I think you see all sorts of interesting things there. Caribou fences stretching for many kilometers. I think on what we call Beothuk Lake now, I think at least there's 50 kilometers of these caribou fences for channeling caribou into certain kill traps.
Like rock cairns that basically funnel the caribou like they have, like a bison run almost, right?
Yeah, but they're actually trees. And I think, you know, minimally it was just cutting a tree and letting it sort of fall down like a triangle and, you know, just things to, but I think they could be more elaborate fences than that, things hanging from them to just sort of spook caribou, into certain caribou crossing spots. We have historic accounts of these like large storage facilities, just hundreds of pounds of caribou meat in there above ground, some underground storage. Again, there's difference of opinions, but I see this all as sort of artifacts of the historic period. When you look at like the sort of that late prehistory, that late boreal woodland kind of time period, the Beothuk aren't really operating very far inland. And let's face it, you don't have to go really far inland to hunt caribou or anything. So if you're just thinking about a sort of safety net option, it's that those deep bays and inlets give you a lot of room to kind of exploit a range of things. And then later on, it seems like they're just bearing down on kind of caribou. I mean, there's other things I could, I'll just see where you want to go from here. I mean, there's other things I could talk about that I think are happening then, but.
Sure, go for it.
I think, you know, there's things that are going socially and culturally. I mean, the houses, written on this recently with some colleagues, but the houses are getting bigger, they're getting deeper. So I think that those are all indications of increasing sedentism. I think the Beothuk, you know, probably prior to Europeans are maybe hunting caribou just in the fall, but I think now they're trying to get that spring caribou migration. Again, they're settling there for longer periods of time. The houses are increasing. I think, you know, you have might have a little bit more of a household-focused kind of economy than sort of a group-focused economy.
And for the listener, like the bigger houses, too, could be an indication of sort of more people living under one roof as probably kind of a buffering strategy, you know, that you've got more people, like you're safer in numbers sort of idea. Or is it just that groups are kind of coalescing because there's fewer spots to live?
I don't know if there's fewer spots to live. I think it could be like there's, especially later on, I think there could be like the, what you want to call broken home sort of situation where people are just absorbing people into households. But it could have been also a kind of economic strategy where production and storage is kind of at the household level now. And so there's incentive to have sort of larger households. Again, I think maybe sort of like you see on the Northwest Coast, from my understanding of kind of that the household archaeology there, right, where you just like bigger households.
Oh, sorry, I was gonna say that actually ties in a little bit to our theme this season, which is supposed to be complexity.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and we actually just talked to Gary Copeland a little bit about big like Northwest Coast houses. So, it, and some of the stuff you're talking about, like storage and these kinds of things, are like, you know, kind of classic hunter-gatherer complexity topics. So is that sort of what you think you're seeing, but for very different reasons than we often imagine this occurring?
I mean, I think there's a little nudge towards maybe property rights kind of things changing. There's an interesting, I think it was my friend and colleague John Irwin who spotted this, but we were rereading Howley's classic book on the Beothuk, you know, written in 1915, and looking at Shaunadith, its famous drawings that are reproduced in the book. But there's a drawing of a storage facility, and Howley's sort of version of it leaves out an important element, whereas if you look at Shaunadith, it's kind of hard to describe on a podcast, but if you look at Shaunadith, its original drawing, it looks like there are these like kind of storage units that there's a big storage facility, and then there's a number of little storage packets, I guess you would say, in that facility. So we're thinking those might represent like households.
It's like a self-storage unit.
Yeah,
or but like it's like kids talk about their cubbies at school.
Yeah, I guess the analogy would be if everybody on your street had one giant storehouse, but within that you had your area. So it seems like there's these little compartments. So
Canada Post calls those neighborhood mailboxes.
So obviously I'm not trying to say that things are anywhere like maybe they are in the Northwest Coast, but there's a nudge, I think, a little bit in that direction that was different from prior to Europeans arriving. I think things are happening on that level. There's also, I think, interesting things happening ideologically. You have the Beothuk. You see like sort of items like binders for books, kitchen utensils that are appearing in Beothuk sites. It's different than nails and the kinds of things you would scavenge from a fishing site. It's almost like they're trophies, like war trophies. And like, I think this is when the Ba'athic are, you know, we might call it a revitalization movement. I think they're kind of creating some ideas of Europeans that are just, you know, they're obviously they're not our friends, and we're going to steal stuff from them, and we're going to, you know, we're going to commit violence against them. And there are kind of some interesting stories, like from Fogo Island, where, you know, which is certainly in the early 1800s is way out there on the coast, and the Ba'athic go out there and they attack these two settlers, and you know, they kill one, they behead him, and we also know from other accounts that they're taking people's heads and bringing them inland and having various kind of ceremonies or rituals or celebrations around them. So I think there's something kind of interesting going on there where they've, you know, I think that's different than probably how those early interactions with Europeans were. I think things have taken a kind of turn.
Yeah, that, what you're describing is the opposite of indirect interaction.
Exactly. And do you see those kinds of, like, this is happening with Europeans, but do you see those kinds of, any kind of interaction that suggests violence between Ba'athic and the Dorset? Like, is that something that's happening, like, in the past before Europeans?
Yeah, we just don't have the evidence for that. I will, again, I lean a little bit towards those Dorset interactions. Maybe were not as great as some people think they were. And that comes from the fact that the Dorset are on some pretty prime real estate on the island. And when they leave, the Ba'athic move in there.
Okay.
So I guess it depends a little bit on your worldview. Are they just kind of like, hey, we'll take these spots, you take them, and we can be separate but equal, or we can like exchange goods, you know, like to, you know. Or they were separate and unequal, which is kind of what I think. I think the Dorset were, it seemed like they had a larger footprint. They're probably maybe a little bit more numerous, and they're in these spots. And when they leave them, the Ba'athic sort of move in there. And we see this, I think you had Chris Wolf on here, you know, a year or so ago, but we, at Stock Cove, there's a famous raw material there called Trinity Bay Chert, and the Dorset are just using it for everything. It's like a machine, you know, a factory over there. And during that time when the Dorset are on the island, these ancestral Ba'athic who were sharing the island with them are not using that material. I mean, I've looked at collections and tried to find it. Maybe there's a couple examples that could be out of that. But then when they're gone, they're using it. So it's like the Dorset had kind of access to this raw material, and somehow the First Nations ancestral Ba'athic are not having access to it, and then they are, and they're using it.
Okay.
Very cool.
And we should say, so who are the Dorset, Don? Sorry, yep. I guess we should introduce that for the listener, too. Yep.
Dorset are an Inuit people, Paleo-Inuit people that probably derive from an earlier group called the Gross Water people who are on the island. That goes back to, you know, 800 or so, I think, before Common Era, but they're derived from them. And they're on the island when the ancestral Ba'athic people arrive. And then, like I said, there's a climate change. What is it? Medieval climatic anomaly. So things start warming up around 500 Common Era. And we think, like, you know, one idea is that it's reducing sea ice conditions, and the Dorset are all in on the harp seals. And as go the harp seals, so do the Dorset, and they retreat north. You know, I've got thoughts on that too, but
yeah,
I don't know.
And we should, Ken, we should link to Don's paper about that in the show notes. It was in your book there, Don, Hunter-Gatherer, Archaeologist, Historical mm-hmm. Process. You write a fair bit about that, so yeah. we'll put that in the show notes. So we've talked a little bit about Ba'athic-European interaction, Ba'athic-Dorset interaction. And I was reminded, and had you on, I don't think I've ever asked you this, at the University of Connecticut, there was a map of like indigenous languages,
when I was a grad student there. It was really old, and I thought it was interesting. It had them all colored in, except like Newfoundland was just gray. And so I was wondering, where are we these days? Where are scholars on the relationship between the Beothuk and the Wabanaki?
Yeah, this is like a really challenging question. And, you know, it's been a long time question in the sense of, you know, I think if we go back to sort of early archaeology in this area and thinking that both of you know well, but people were connecting the Beothuk to the so-called red paint people. So we're talking about archaic people. And so, you know, that was an idea that the Beothuk were sort of survivals of these people. Jim Tuck, famous archaeologist, of course, at Memorial University, sort of continued that, but with the idea that that the archaic people were Algonquin speakers, and then the, you know, there's kind of a line that goes from there to, you know, the Beothuk. But when I started writing this book on the Eastern Subarctic, I got into sort of the genetic research, and I don't believe it's changed, but that was indicating the Beothuk are not maritime archaic, so they're not connected there. And then I was getting into the linguistic stuff on sort of the origin of the Algonquin language family, which puts it kind of in the Great Lakes and diverging around 2,000 years ago. So I kind of was of the opinion that, okay, the Beothuk are not, you know, there's not this kind of direct line from the archaic. So the Algonquin language, I think that, again, in the book, what I was seeing there and from what the glottochronology, whatever the linguistic estimates are, is that it's spreading into the Eastern Subarctic, Eastern Atlantic, 2,000 or so years ago. There's some other interesting things that are happening then where you get some ceramics. Bow and arrows a little bit later, but it's kind of in that you get a kind of flurry of exchange, especially with Rama Chert, which is coming down from Labrador. So there seems to be this like invigoration that's happening then. I think, again, it's another article, but the demography, I think you see like an increase in sort of site numbers. So something's happening then. And so my thought was, okay, this is sort of Algonquin people moving into that area. And it's not an empty landscape, but I think it is a depopulated one. I mean, that's another conversation. But I think, you know, something kind of bad happens at the end of the archaic, and there's a bit of a population crash, and people are, of course, still there. But there's, you know, they're maybe getting a little swamped by some people coming from the Great Lakes area. So my thinking was, the Beothuk are somehow connected to that expansion. And it's because there's a lot of, I see cultural similarity between, you know, you have these chapatoins, which are these sort of long linear hearth features, which were nested within these homes. So I saw a lot there to think the Beothuk are somehow connected. But the Beothuk language does seem to be, the little we know about it does seem to be different. So are they some really early version of the Algonquin language? Are they some derivative of it? Or is it that, again, that population that's nested in there in Labrador, is there some amalgamation of language there? That's, I think, the mystery is. And so this is a long way of saying we really need some linguists, if you're listening to this, somebody's really needs to revisit the Beothuk language stuff. Here are the problems. The problems are there's not a lot of words. The word lists are inherently problematic because they're taken down by various people who don't know how to do proper word lists, right? So you don't know if they're... It's kind of like me, right? I don't have that skill set. So if you were talking to me in a language I didn't understand, I'd try to write it in something that approximates what I heard. And so, you have these different very short word lists by different people. And so the basic data is problematic. And I think also with that early stuff, the other problem was that they were tacking on to their linguistic interpretations old ideas of sort of culture history, like that remote places mean remote cultures, you know, so we can get into fusionism, but right, like this idea like Newfoundland being this sort of cold island in the north must be this sort of reservoir of old, you know, these sort of ideas that they're sort of isolated there. And so a lot of that was sort of evidence for some of that language work back then, or and ideas of like primitive, like, all right, well, we talked about beheading, but, you know, there was this idea like beheading came before scalping, you know, just dumb stuff. But like, so if the Beothuk are beheaders, then they represent some old culture, you know.
And you mentioned like Frank Speck in your book as being one of the kind of guys who's advancing that sort of, as you get more remote, things yeah. get more like they used to be. Sorry, yeah. Ken, I'll let you
yeah.
go now.
Yeah, yeah. And for the listeners, so the reason that we don't know much about Beothuk language is that mm-hmm. we don't have a population and a descendant population, basically, of Beothuk. And so what happens to the Beothuk in the 19th century, I guess?
Well, they're, by all counts, their population is dwindling. They, again, we talked about them retreating. So the other reason we don't really have a lot of information on them is they're not interacting with Europeans in the way that other indigenous populations are in the Northeast. So they're kind of actively avoiding Europeans. And so much of what we know about them comes from this woman, Shauna Diffitt, who died in 1829, lived for several years in St. John's and was sort of mined for information about the Beothuk. So some of that linguistic data we have is from her and an earlier Beothuk woman who was captured, Damastuit. So yeah, I mean, the Beothuk basically disappear. Now, what happens to them, you know, is a matter of sort of debate and discussion. Do they retreat to Labrador, some surviving element of the Beothuk, and merge with, do they merge with Mi'kmaq people who are now on the island of Newfoundland? So those are all sort of plausible. And you know, I certainly Frank Speck, circling back to Frank Speck, but he met a woman who claimed a father was Beothuk. So you know, that seems plausible, but certainly as an autonomous cultural entity, they seem to have disappeared. And by the way, this isn't like unusual. You know, if you're sort of familiar with, you know, the contact experience in the Americas, you have lots of groups that just kind of get shattered and then they reform in different sort of groups, right? There's this process called ethnogenesis, where people are sort of forming new ethnic identities, you know, that are entirely new. So you have a lot of groups that are sort of disbanded and then reorganized. I know Gabe, you know, in Connecticut, you see that too. Like, I mean, these are complicated issues with the Pequot and groups there as well. So I don't...
Anywhere Frank Speck spent a lot of time, yes, as an example. Yeah,
I mean, I really generally don't think people go extinct, and it's absolutely not in the genetic sense, but, you know, there's not a strong thread of continuity that, certainly there's not a reservoir of information where we learn much about linguistics today from people.
And so the listeners got the sense probably from you, Don, and this is true, yeah, as far as I can tell, that you think about hunter-gatherers pretty broadly. You're kind of a hunter-gatherer guy. What led you to do work in Newfoundland and the subarctic? Kind of what was your journey to that, and why do you think that the subarctic and Newfoundland are the kind of places where you wanted to study hunter-gatherers?
Okay, well, there's two kind of answers to that. One is the way I became interested early on in archaeology and where I wanted to work was mostly kind of places I wanted to visit. But like, let's all remember when we're young, like if we're being honest, a lot of us, it's not like some research question was driving my thoughts at 21. It was, I want to go to New Brunswick, or I want to go to Newfoundland. I want to, like, these places intrigue me. And of course I was familiar with, you know, the archaeology a bit and the indigenous history, and that's all. It wasn't coming from necessarily a question, but those happen once you go to those places and you start doing the archaeology and you start reading the literature, and then you get kind of caught up in, like, the question. So the first part is just like being intrigued by sort of, I had taken a class on hunters and gatherers, and I was, they sparked my interest. And then the idea of hunters and gatherers living in what I thought were cool places like the subarctic and the Aleutians and other places. Then you start getting into the question. And in terms of, like, now for turning to questions and theories, and we're get a little bit in the weeds about kind of theories, but a lot of us, and I don't know, I assume you have some grad students listening to this, you know, you tend to kind of respond to the generation before you, and usually it's a sort of rejection, or you're challenging them on kind of their position. And so for me, the generation before me was thinking about hunters and gatherers in terms of adaptation. It was a very, like, people-less approach to archaeology, where it was very focused on artifacts rather than societies. It was based on sort of seeking laws of human behavior rather than interest in history. It was about thinking about hunter-gatherer adaptations and foraging behavior as sort of algorithms rather than reflections of culture. My whole, you know, a lot of my career has been kind of challenging that with hunters and gatherers. If you think about it, like, where is, like, ground zero for taking that on in sort of, in a way, the most challenging places? And it's the subarctic, meaning, like, you know, the Northwest coast, which you've been talking about, is people might admit there that hunters and gatherers have agency and they could do things for cultural and political reasons. But in places like the Eastern subarctic, environmental determinism was, you know, a pretty powerful way of thinking about hunter-gatherer adaptations. There was really no room for error. So everything in that hunters and gatherers did was some sort of, like, calculated survival strategy. And I wanted to bring, I wanted to bring history and sort of culture to those places. Like, what, you know, could we challenge that narrative with agency and, you know, and that's, I think, most of my career has been trying to do that.
Yeah,
right.
With a couple
including
books
recently
on specifically on that topic.
And including recently with a paper we did as a hit piece here recently, The Archaeology Forgetting the Dorset and Arctic Antiquity with Max Friesen. And so we know the listeners always read our suggestions. So they'll all be caught up on that. But we may have some people who've just kind of joined for the first time. And so tell us a little bit about this. What did the Dorset forget?
Yeah. So it's an article about forgetting in the archaeological record, and then using the Dorset, again, the aforementioned Paleo-Inuit people who were spread across the Eastern Arctic and down into Newfoundland for a while. So we talk about three kinds of forgetting. There's the sort of passive forgetting that, again, you might think of as adaptation forgetting. In other words, the kind of forgetting that happens just with culture change. We moved on to cars and we don't have horses anymore. So there's, like, knowledge of horses, I guess, that would be lost by regular people. So that's kind of passive forgetting. There's the unintentional forgetting of, I think, like, the analogy might be a disaster scenario. If we lost 95% of the world's population, you could think about the things that we would know. Like, would anybody be able to recreate a nuclear reactor? You know, there's certain specialized technologies, and we could probably end up illiterate, you know, honestly, if our whole life ways changed. So, like, that information would be lost. And then there's the intentional.
I think we're rapidly getting there already.
We might end on that today.
Well, and thanks for tuning in.
Happy Friday.
Yeah, another bright day on the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. Yeah.
So that's the kind of unintentional forgetting. Then there's the intentional forgetting, where you kind of are erasing, which might be happening too, but, like, the erasing of sort of memory, you know, like burning books. But it could be, like, of your own initiative, if you converted and you changed religion, you might want to, like, you know, kind of try to forget that kind of stuff, and you're pivoting. Or people, my mom, right? She never taught me German. She was fluent. She was from Germany. That you could say her decision to not teach me was a kind of intentional forgetting. She, you know, she was pivoting and wanted to be an American citizen and teach her and not have her kids, for whatever reason, learn German. So those are sort of the three kinds of forgetting. And then with the Dorset, there's some interesting things that happen where there's a period where they're there's a transition between pre-Dorset and what come to be known as the Dorset, where you see stuff that the pre-Dorset had that Dorset don't have. Is one. So people before them had the bow and arrow, the Dorset don't. Drills, like a stone drill for drilling into things. Pre-Dorset had it, the Dorset don't. So when you find like a hole basically in a Dorset artifact, it's gouged, kind of like you've taken a needle or something and you're just jamming a little hole into it rather than using a spinning drill. Boat technology, I think there's some for the Dorset now, but it's pretty slim. But you have this sort of marine technology with pre-Dorset that disappears. I think those are the big ones. Dogs disappear as well. They don't seem to have ever been really that popular with pre-Dorset, but then they seem to completely vanish with the Dorset. So what we try to do in this paper is just think through different ways of explaining why these things might have disappeared using those kind of lenses, those three kind of options.
Yeah. None of which are sort of conclusive, but these might be different reasons why we're seeing these archaeological results. That's great. And we'll direct the listener again to the excellent summary of Labrador at Newfoundland Labrador culture history in that paper that I will be using as I teach subarctic stuff in the future.
Because the grad students that do listen are all cramming for comps. That's the reason they listen.
Exactly. So, we did a series kind of on pseudo-archaeology stuff a couple of years ago with a few people. And you did a term as the book review editor of American Antiquity and headed up a special series of book reviews that you started with an essay talking to the guy on the airplane in which you discuss pseudo-archaeology theories that fascinate the public. So Oak Island, aliens, Egyptians inventing light bulbs. And then there were a series of reviews engaging with some of those conspiracies and some of those books. We're about a decade out from that essay and those collections, and we're in fairly interesting times. You know, like there's, I would say, a far greater number of places to get those kinds of ideas than there were even 10 years ago. So what are your thoughts on pseudo-archaeology and about conspirational thinking in general, and are those related?
Yeah, I'll just a little background on that book review. So, you know, this was my final issue as book review editor for American Antiquity. So I was book review editor for 3 years or so. And, you know, you keep hearing about sort of pseudo-archaeology, that kind of crowd being like, you know, the archaeologists aren't engaging with our stuff. You know, it's like there's a conspiracy theory too, like that we sort of believe it or we know it's true, but for whatever weird reason, we don't want to admit
we're hiding
it.
All the
yeah,
facts.
We're hiding it. So
you can insert a sound effect here, Emmanuel.
Yeah. And so I kind of was like, all right, you know, you want an archaeologist take on it, let's do it. And that was kind of like, let's have the archaeologist review it. So that's kind of where those reviews come from. I'm taking another flight with the guy on the airplane in a book I'm finishing up right now on hunters and gatherers. So maybe in a year or so we could talk about that. But that book's about dispelling kind of misconceptions about hunters and gatherers. So, you know, I invoke this sort of everyman guy again as a sort of counter on that. But anyway, I was finishing something on that book recently, and I was thinking about how answers are easy when you have few data points. The more you know, the more complicated things are. And for like outside of academia, you could talk about like my HVAC repair person, you ask these people, or your doctor, your family doctor, a pretty straightforward question, and you get like usually a more complicated answer than you wanted. And it's kind of frustrating. And the reason is because they've seen the exception, right? Like if they had done three HVAC repairs, they probably would have a pretty simple answer. But they've seen hundreds of them. And so their responses are full of caveats and like, you know, but I've also, this is another possible reason why it's doing that. Or, you know, this could be it. And I think with archaeologists, we know all those exceptions and we know how complicated things are. But let's face it. I mean, people are attracted to easy answers. And it's also archaeologists aren't easy to come by. So they can find some pretty easy answers.
Speak for yourself, Don. I'm pretty.
HVAC repair people in the wild are a little bit more common than, you know, Eastern subarctic archaeologists. But so they have few data points and, you know, they're just kind of their easy answers. There's an attractiveness, of course, to easy answers. You know, you see it in politics and religion and lots of things. And if we're being honest, you see it in academia. If you can distill things down to a sort of one size fits all theory, you're going to get a lot of citations and you're going to sell a lot of books. And if we're just kind of talking broadly about, you know, issues in the world today, I would like to get to a place where we acknowledge that there's a gray space there and things are more complicated and the answers aren't easy. You know, there's a lot of things pushing back against that. There's, you know, a lot of demand for people's attention. And it's easy to get people's attention when you have a really interesting idea that may or may not be true, but it's simple and it's interesting and intriguing and it garners clicks and attention. I also think like with social media, I think there's like a lot of pressure to have an opinion on things. You know, I think people in the past just felt more comfortable being like, you know, I don't really know that. I don't know the answer, but there's like, people need to like, you know, like you hear, like you see something on the news and it's like, you're supposed to have an opinion and post your opinion on it. And I don't know. I think there's pressure for that. Whereas again, in the past, it's like, well, you know, I'm not an HVAC person, so I'm not going to really say what the reason is, but people for whatever, they feel some sort of pressure to do it or they're incentivized in some way to have these opinions.
Yeah. And the AI algorithm, I think, is trying to get those opinions so it can, you know, learn to be more human and take us over. And, yeah. and I'm realizing that I said the word conspirational because of a, I was reading the last question, because of the ink on my printer merged the letters. So conspiratorial was actually the word that I was looking for. Yeah. I'm not even sure if
Well, it's a funny coincidence that the ink smeared on that question, isn't it?
Exactly. So, Don, we're cognizant of the time, but I kind of, we were talking beforehand, it's an auspicious day in the music world. And so you've used a variety of literary devices and inspirations in your writing. And so you've talked about travel writing as a way to think about like how people engage with or think about hunter-gatherers and popular literature. You've used the lookout tree as to frame sort of Speck's engagement with Beothic landscapes. You've invoked Iron Maiden, I think, for a colonial encounter. On the New Brunswick Archaeology podcast, we're all about promoting up-and-coming artists, and we know that you're a big fan of this female vocalist that goes by the name of Taylor Swift, who happens to have a new album out today. And so I guess we want to close with the question is, when can we expect an archaeological device that brings her work into your writing? When's the next, what's the Taylor Swift archaeology fusion there?
You might see Taylor reference in this book I'm working on.
Okay.
Excellent.
I'll leave it at that. But, you know, I did think about, I was thinking about, again, the opinion. I was kind of saying, like, my daughter already wants to know what my favorite songs are on this album. That was literally released at midnight. So, but that's like, right? I mean, I bet if you went on the news, there would be people writing reviews of the albums. And it just.
I mean, why do you think Ken was late?
I mean, the upside is that we've mentioned Taylor Swift now in this episode, and we'll put that in the hashtag, and this will probably be the most listened to episode we've ever had. So
the most listened to first 8 minutes of an episode we've ever had.
Well, you know what? My daughter will find that reference online, and then she'll be like, oh my gosh, my dad's on this podcast. So this is like a really roundabout way to get her to listen to anything that I do. She'll just, you know.
This is how we passively teach people about the Beothic, is we just include a Taylor Swift reference. That's
Well, Don, we really appreciate you coming on to talk about this with us.
Yeah.
And hopefully going to see you here. Well, I guess we're not going to, are you going to the SAA? We're not going to the SAA, so we probably won't see you there, but hopefully catch up soon.
The CAAs are in Canmore. It's a beautiful spot in the mountains.
Yes, I know. I think, yeah, I was being strategic about conferences. The AAAs, American Anthropological Association meetings, are going to be in St. Louis, which is not far from me, in not this November, but next November. So I was thinking about that.
Cool.
Yeah, I need to get back to the CAAs for sure.
Well,
the three of us could do a panel at the AAAs on Cahokia. We could just sit. You've already got the sort of like sportscaster headset. We could sort of take the listener on a stroll around Cahokia.
Have either of you been to Cahokia?
No, I haven't.
If you come to St. Louis, I'll show you.
Yeah.
All right.
Sure.
Can't wait.
There we go. Live from Cahokia, folks. That's the next one.
Yep. All right. Thanks very much.
Thanks again for coming on. Take care.
All right, Ken, well, I think it's time for Hit Pieces. Fairly local Hit Pieces from the most recent Archaeology of Eastern North America.
Yeah, I think not just local, but authorship.
Local to this podcast.
Highly local to this podcast. And so we might as well go in order of where they appear journal volume. And so the first one.
And we should say it's volume 53, and it's in ANA is an annual. So that's this year's Archaeology of Eastern North America.
Yeah, yeah. So this is a regional archaeology, kind of the this and Northeast anthropology are kind of the pinnacle regional Northeast anthropology and archaeology publications. And so, you know, kind of a great place to go to learn about the region. And mm-hmm. so the first one, which is called Carboniferous Cherts and the Archaeology of Washtenaw Lake, New Brunswick, Canada, is by yours truly, pages 29 to 56, I think. I don't have my issue in front of me.
I just
have a table of contents that was shared on social media. And so Gabe and I are patiently awaiting our issues in the mail. This paper is basically the culmination of my probably 15 plus years of doing research in the lower Wollastoog, and in particular research around the quarries on Washtenaw Lake. So the Bellier's Cove Quarry that's along the lakeshore that kind of runs from Bellier's Cove all the way around to McDonald Point. Really kind of picking up where David Black and Lucy Wilson left off. So they have a paper in 1999 called, I didn't pull that up, but it's probably in my references here. I can pull that very quickly.
And that's sort of introducing the Washtenaw.
Yeah, so introducing, it's called the Washtenaw Lake Chert Source, Queens County, New Brunswick. And so throughout my master's and throughout my PhD research, I have studied the archaeological site patterning around the lake, and I've done some geoarchaeological work in the area, basically looking for other potential geological occurrences of what we call Carboniferous Cherts. And so the kind of the two big summaries of this are that there are a variety of different places in New Brunswick where you could get Carboniferous Cherts, many of which are multicolored, fine-grained. But there are only two places that I have found where indigenous people in the past used them as quarries. And one of the lessons that came out of this research is that although Washtenaw chert, as we call it, or Washtenaw multicolored chert, which is kind of the long form, is a Carboniferous chert, not all Carboniferous cherts are necessarily Washtenaw multicolored chert. And that is because Over the course of my research, we also found a secondary quarry at a place called Henderson Settlement, just east of the lake. And so this is both a geological occurrence of stone and another place where indigenous people would have been getting very bright, fine-grained cherts in the past. And so the paper is sort of a review of the research that's gone on at the quarry, kind of rehashing a little bit of kind of the history around it that is covered in the Black and Wilson paper. And then I summarize basically the 40 some odd sites that I looked at as part of my thesis that are scattered throughout the lake, some of which I identified myself, some of which Gabe and I found during a survey in 2010 or 2011. I can't remember what year it was. And
it was
then
duck season, I remember that much.
And then some of the geological work that I've done in trying to identify whether or not you can distinguish between the two sources that we've identified. And so the findings basically suggest that there's sort of an increasing frequency of erosion of sites. And so I think part of the reason we're finding so many archaeological sites around the lakeshore is that they are continuing to erode. I do some preliminary description of some of the rather the really interesting assemblage that's held by a private collection at McDonald's Point, and talk a little bit about the field work that I've done testing and describing this other quarry. And so some lithic technological data in there, some interesting pictures of cherts, basically kind of recognizing that the area around the quarry was probably a very active landscape, and based on the distribution of what we understand as sites in the area, was essentially the whole landscape around the quarry was being used. And it doesn't appear how some of these other lithic quarries, which you see like sort of sheets of stone piled on top of one another, ancestral Wabanaki and Wolastoqiyik were basically occupying the whole shoreline area and using it for a variety of different purposes. So for camping and for lithic extraction and initial preparation of tools, but probably also like living on along the shoreline at different times and into what we believe to be probably at least the 18th and certainly into the 19th and 20th centuries, Wolastoqiyik were visiting in the summers. So
that's great. And Ken, am I right that one of the take-home points from that paper is that people may have been using materials that were consistent with Washtenaw chert from that alternative source much deeper in time than previously realized?
Yeah. So during the course of my research, I found a number of examples of what appears to be Washtenaw chert coming from contexts that are very early, so Paleo-Indian sites. And these are certainly Carboniferous cherts, but it was unlikely to be Washtenaw because at that time, we believe that Washtenaw chert source on the lake was actually underwater. And this other quarry at Henderson Settlement is possibly one of the sources where earlier evidence of Carboniferous cherts could be coming from. So we don't have anything conclusive from the quarry that points to it being a Paleo-Indian quarry, but certainly by relative elevation, the location of the site is consistent with where you might expect to find a source during the late Pleistocene, basically. Or you certainly could have accessed that stuff in the late Pleistocene.
Terrific. And then our other hit piece is by Alexander Hansinger, Alex Peltier-Michaud, Arthur Anderson, me, and Jan Hendrik Carol Pools. And it's called Provenance, Petrography, and Distribution of Quaddy Speckled Mudstone, a distinctive lithic raw material from the main New Brunswick Quaddy region. And what this article is about is it's about a stone commonly called Hinkley Point metasediment. And the mystery here was that this stone appears actually often in ritual context throughout New England and appeared to originate in the Quaddy region, widely speculated at a place called Hinkley Point. Somewhat embarrassingly, surveys to relocate this had been unsuccessful because we didn't realize that it weathers into the way it looks in archaeological collections, which is into that speckled look. And this reports on basically a multi-year quest to find that material. And then once we found it, to do some geological work to describe it better so that folks might be able to better identify it in their collections and that we might be better able to identify it in those collections. So that's what that's about.
Yeah, so the Hink is out there, folks.
The Hink is out there.
And actually, in a couple of fortnights, we'll be talking to Alex Peltier-Michaud, who we just talked to, but through the beauty of time travel, you'll hear Alex talk a little bit about the Hink in the context of an archaeological site in northern New Brunswick.
That's right. And so it's exciting, Kent, to see. It looks like it's going to be a good ANA when my copy arrives. But it's nice to have two articles from the Maritime Peninsula in here.
Yeah. So I think it's continuing a trend. Like I said, we're pretty flush with hit pieces, and there seems to be, you know, a few more kind of rolling in throughout the fall. And very exciting that there's a lot of research going on in the region and tying in researchers from the region. So, listener, we're bringing New Brunswick into the broader Northeast discussions in a bigger way.
That's right. Well, listener, I think Ken and I are going to let you go here, but we'll look forward to talking to you in about a fortnight.
Yes, we'll talk to you soon, listener. Enjoy the trip up to Newfoundland, and I hope the bugs weren't too bad.
Talk to you soon, listener.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.